Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the first week of June, and this week we saw families in Uvalde, Texas, and others across the country buried their loved ones who were victims of a mass shooting. The horrors of these killings is unacceptable, but our lawmakers can't seem to pass legislation or agree on how to stop them. Do we need more mental health treatment, gun regulations, removing guns from the streets? Let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. This week, we're trying something a little bit new. I'm your guest host and your left, even though I'm kind of a Rancho Libertarian. But of course, we're still going to have a center and a right, and we're also going to have a special guest later on in the show. On the right, I'm joined by Sarah Isger. She's the host of the legal podcast, Advisory Opinions, from The Dispatch. She was a spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. Sarah, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And from the center, we're joined by Tara Settmayer. She's a senior advisor at the Lincoln Project and a resident scholar at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. And back when she was still a Republican, she was a communications director on Capitol Hill. Hello, Tara.
Thank you for having me.
So, President Biden delivered an address on the mass shootings and urged Congress to pass common sense laws. Meanwhile, Congress was out on break this week, but a bipartisan group of senators is working on finding some compromise legislation that could make it through Congress. Some basic ideas, like raising the age requirement to purchase automatic weapons, are starting to bubble up. But to date, Republicans on Capitol Hill have not been interested, seemingly, in passing any gun control measures. Sarah, what's the federal legislation you hope they'll come up with that you think could actually make it through Congress?
So I think it's interesting that Mitch McConnell has deputized John Cornyn to lead the negotiations on this. I think that in and of itself is new in the lack of action we've seen for the last 20 years. Obviously, John Cornyn is a conservative Republican senator from Texas as well, both where this most recent tragedy has happened, but also a state known for its gun rights, of course. Now, if you're betting in D.C., always bet against action. So even though I think there's some hopeful signs this time around, this could all be eclipsed by whatever takes over the news cycle next and go back on the back burner. But obviously, the conversation is centered around a more narrow set of proposals, which I also think it has more likelihood of moving forward. You know, sometimes in the past, we've seen a gun package proposal, mostly written by Democrats. It's far-reaching. They know Republicans aren't going to get on board with it. It's frankly a political talking point for both sides that benefit, right? Democrats can say Republicans are intransigent on gun issues, and Republicans can say they prevented Democrats from taking your guns, and everyone wins at the ballot box. And the only people losing, of course, are voters. So red flag laws, talking about having a federal red flag law instead of leaving that just to a patchwork of state laws. Now, there were New York red flag laws, and police did talk to the Buffalo shooter, but they didn't use those red flag laws in that case. And so I think it's important when we talk about any of these to remember there's no single panacea. And so anyone who says, well, that wouldn't have prevented X, they will always win this debate, and I think we have to stop listening to those voices, frankly. Raising the age for buying some of these weapons from 18 to 21. Again, some states have done it. Interestingly, the Ninth Circuit struck down a California version of that law recently, though I think that's unlikely to stand. But plenty of other states, including Florida, have similar laws increasing the age. I do not think that would be found unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. And then lastly, doing more on background checks, but it's little unclear what that could look like. You know, folks throw around the term expanded background checks, but that can mean any number of things. The one that I think is most interesting is the Charleston loophole, where you don't ever hear back from the federal government on a background check. And after 3 days, you then just get to buy a gun, even though you didn't pass a background check. Expanding that time to 10 days, 20 days, whatever it might be, certainly is something that I think should be on the table.
Tara, do you think or do you agree with Sarah that maybe Congress going a little bit more narrow is going to finally create some sort of legislation?
I do, actually, this time, because the horror, the shock and awe of seeing children being gunned down oftentimes rattles people and shakes them into doing something. Many would argue that after Sandy Hook in 2012, that not enough was done. And it's taken a decade of many more mass shootings in schools to get incremental changes made. Sarah mentioned the red flag laws. After Parkland in 2018, Florida enacted a red flag law, which has been rather successful. They've been able to get 8,000 guns away from people using the red flag laws, and who knows how many tragedies that may have prevented. But it has to be enforced and implemented properly. Sarah also mentioned the failure of a red flag law in New York to prevent the Buffalo shooter from obtaining a weapon and carrying out the tragedy there. So but this is, I think, where there's agreement is that the concepts behind red flag laws is something that more people can get behind, where we can have bipartisan support for that. And it's a reasonable approach, one of many, because we all know that there is no one single solution to this. It's not just banning a certain type of weapon or banning a certain type of ammunition. We are a gun-loving country. We have a Second Amendment. There are more guns than people. The AR-15 specifically is the most popular gun for gun owners in this country. There's millions of them. So we're not, the idea of banning anything, I think, unfortunately forces people into their own respective corners, however you may feel about that weapon. That's not productive. So I think that's a non-starter for a lot of Republicans for various reasons. But middle ground areas about background checks and red flag laws and possibly regulating certain types of ammunition or the bump stocks issue, I think that is an area that even Senator Chris Murphy has said that these are areas that he's seeing bipartisan support that he has never seen before on this issue. So will we see major legislation? I'm not so sure, but I think taking pieces of these different various aspects that contribute to these shootings, we actually may see some success there.
Yeah, I think that the middle ground now is people are agreeing maybe you should make it a little bit harder to get stuff like AR-15s. My cousins, who all have their guns, they love their shotguns, their rifles, all of that. They, you know, we had a party over the weekend, and they're coming up to me because I'm the media guy saying, like, how is it that an 18-year-old could just like that buy a gun, buy an AR-15 like that? And for me, it's like, why is it harder for me to be able to learn how to ride a motorcycle and get the license to do that than buying a gun? Of course, I live in California, so it's a little bit harder for me, but it's far easier to do some of these things. So for me, I want to see, you know, more background checks with AR-15s, really make it as hard as possible to buy those ones. I would love to see a federal ban like we had for a decade. We had a decade-long ban on federal, or rather on assault weapons in California. We had one since the 1980s until a Trump-appointed judge ruled that unconstitutional. And yes, massacres continue to happen, but we worship guns. We have a gun cult here in the United States. And so it's a murderous cult. So the harder we can make it to have people worship those guns, especially the higher capacity ones, I think the better.
The problem that you run into on the right, especially, is why AR-15s? They look scary, but they're just as deadly as any handgun.
Yeah, the slippery slope. Yeah.
Well, not that it's a slippery slope. They're the same.
Not quite, though. Not quite the same. To Sarah's point, that's correct. It is a semi-automatic weapon. Automatic weapons are already illegal. You're not allowed to have a machine gun or anything like that in this country. But the difference is the AR-15, what it does to the body. And it's different than what a 9mm does to the body as far as the impact that it has. So much so that we're seeing specific trainings for tourniquets on how to handle bullet wounds from AR-15 style weapons. So there is some difference between the AR-15 and handguns where you can make that argument. But then the other side of it too, just factually, that the majority of mass shootings in this country, which is defined by the FBI as four or more people shot in one instance, they're committed with handguns. They're not committed with AR-15s. What you see in the, you know, what's considered lawful, a lawful mass shooting is what you see in the inner cities, or when someone gets shot, you know, when you have people shot at a party, this is not happening with AR-15s. So then the other side, for responsible gun owners, they worry, well, what happens once you come for the AR-15? What about my handgun that I lawfully own, that I'm responsible with, that I'm entitled to through the Constitution, that I use to protect myself? So that's where you start running into those arguments.
bans, I agree, are going to be virtually impossible, especially right now with the Congress we have, especially if the 2022 midterms go in the favor of the Republicans. But I would hope at this point that if both parties or you know, people of all political persuasions could agree, just make it harder for folks. We, you know, what does it say about our country that the most popular weapon, you know, at least when it comes to a gun, is an AR-15? And yeah, and what it does it say about these people? What is it about liberty for these people that an AR-15 represents the epitome of that? Like that to me, I think, of course, Congress will never be able to legislate philosophy. That's a whole other thing. But we're talking about these bans. And out here, you know, in the States, there's a wide range of laws being passed. Here in California, of course, we have some of the strictest gun laws in the nation. Our governor, Gavin Newsom, has proposed new gun legislation modeled after the Texas abortion laws. And he said on Twitter that he plans to propose the largest gun buyback program in the country. He's saying that all these gun regulations have led to less mass shootings than, say, Texas, where he, of course, there's always going to be a rivalry between Texas and California. He says that Texas keeps having these mass shootings and all of this stuff. But of course, Newsom's always going to use his pulpit to make himself and California be the blessed state that we actually are. What do the two of you think and make of Newsom's approach to make California to be like this bastion of we do not like guns here and we're really going to make it as hard as possible for people to buy guns? Sarah.
I actually think the data on some of these questions is really interesting in part because we don't have good data to show that anything matters. And let me walk through what I mean by that. You know, in 2008, the Supreme Court had a historic, really first ruling on the Second Amendment, followed shortly thereafter. They applied it to the states. And overall, for the last 20 years, we've had a loosening of gun laws. You know, you mentioned the lapse of the assault weapons ban. You have a general loosening, even at the state level, of a lot of gun laws. And at the same time, violent crime was going down throughout the country, even though guns and ammunition were proliferating. Now you see, of course, a rise in violent crime, including in states like California, despite more stringent gun laws. And so, you know, if we think that any of these laws in particular are somehow going to flip a switch in the United States, we got another thing coming, of course. And in addition, I'd say there's a tension between the criminal justice reform aspects of our political conversation and the do more on guns. Because when we talk about enforcing the gun laws that we have, which again, I think we should pour money into prosecuting both illegal weapons, by which I mean ghost guns, modified guns that have been allowed now to shoot automatically because they got a kit off the internet, and people who shouldn't have guns, you know, felons in possession, domestic violence, people who lied on their background checks. All of those are things that we massively under-enforce right now. But the truth is, if we enforce those, you're going to have more incarceration and it will disproportionately fall on certain communities and not others.
Tara?
I think that that's right, because there needs to be a holistic approach here. Sarah's point about the difference between gun control measures in response to these tragedies versus the tragedies of the criminal justice system and the problem with illegal gun running and illegal guns being on the streets, gang violence, ghost guns, transporting illegal weapons across state lines. These are all facets of this overall discussion, and they have different impacts. I mean, there are tens of thousands of gun laws already on the books. They mean nothing if they're not properly enforced, or if the local police departments don't have the resources to enforce them, or if local district attorneys or state's attorneys aren't prosecuting gun crimes enough, then we fall into this cycle that we see now. I think that there is a point to be made there. The idea of gun ownership is so embedded in our American psyche and
it's
in certain places.
Yeah.
It can be. You know, I've talked about how, you know, we saw the gun maker, for the gun that was used in the Uvalde shooting, had an ad, a marketing ad with a toddler and an AR-15 with a Bible verse, a proverb, rationalizing this. And I think that kind of marketing is grotesque, frankly. And the same way that we have, you know, we have limits on marketing for cigarettes and alcohol, I think that there needs to be a discussion about the way that weapons of war, if they're not going to ban them, at least make, I don't know that marketing them to children is something that we should be encouraging in this country.
Is there real momentum here to see Congress pass anything? Should the gun lobby be nervous, especially because on the local level, in states and cities and municipalities, they're definitely trying to pass these laws?
Absolutely. And we've seen, you know, New York proposing a new gun package. I think it's worth a second, though, on this idea of a gun lobby. The NRA is the weakest that it's ever been. It's become this term of boogeyman to the left that if you're on the right and are actually, you know, talk to people who are fans of the Second Amendment and gun rights activists, they'll roll their eyes about the NRA. And it's interesting that we talk about like the gun lobby when we're talking about Second Amendment stuff, but we don't talk about like the abortion lobby. And yet the numbers are fascinating. So Planned Parenthood spent $45 million to support candidates in just the 2020 election. The gun rights groups have spent $50 million from 1989 to 2022 to support candidates and party committees. It's just an interesting, I don't know, tactic when we talk about this debate that like it's not really a gun lobby. It's a whole bunch of Americans, millions of them, who vote on this issue. And the people on the other side, you know, the majority, by the way, who want stricter gun laws, they don't vote on it. It's not a number one issue for them.
I'll be back with Tara Setmeyer and Sarah Isger to talk about how to start a political movement. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Gustavo Ariano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times, your guest host coming at you from the left. That's right, we're changing it up, and I'm hosting for a few weeks. In the center is Tara Setmeyer. She's a senior advisor at the Lincoln Project and a resident scholar at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. And on the right is Sarah Isger, staff writer and podcast host at The Dispatch. We're joined now by our special guest, Gal Beckerman. He's a senior editor for books at The Atlantic and also the author of the book, The Quiet Before, on the unexpected origin of radical ideas. Hola, Gal.
Hey, great to be here.
You wrote an article in The Atlantic this week about how frustrated you feel that Americans do want some gun regulation, and yet they don't seem to be able to get it. And I'll quote something you said. How can there be so much consensus among Americans about the need for stricter gun laws? 63% want an outright ban on assault weapons, while we seem locked in this house of horrors, a schoolroom of slaughtered children around every turn with no way out. So you came up with a suggestion, Gal. What is it?
Well, it was the suggestion that I have was based on a few years of research that I've done into social movements and sort of what the conditions under which social movements actually start. And I looked at this issue after, you know, looking historically, suddenly I was faced with an issue that bothers me personally a lot, bothers many Americans that I know a lot. And I thought, well, how do I apply this thinking to right now? And the solution that I came up with for making any kind of real difference, it seems, on the policy level is a sort of student strike. And I can explain a little bit sort of how I got there, but the notion would be that students and parents and teachers take the summer to organize at a local level, create sort of committees locally and build to a set of national demands on gun regulation, and then simply say they're not going back to school in September until Congress does something.
Students have long been on the front lines of these fundamental issues in American history. I'm thinking like the Chicano student blowouts of the 1960s, the marches against anti-immigrant laws in California in the 90s, the Vietnam War way back in the day, George Floyd recently. But why do you put the weight especially on the kids to do this? Like, you mentioned teachers, yeah, but are we adults really this broken and selfish that our kids have to step up to save ourselves again?
In a word, yes.
Damn.
But the thing is, it's their lives on the line. You know, it's really their own personhoods in school every single day, essentially risking their lives. And so it's not so much that I want to burden them with this. Believe me, I have two kids of my own. They've suffered so much under COVID in terms of lost education. You know, it really brings me no joy to say that they should be on the front lines of this battle. But one of the things I tried to do in that article is sort of look at what's worked, what's been effective over time. Because over the last 20 years, let's say since Columbine, that we've had these regular mass shootings in schools, we have learned a few things in terms of what makes a difference, even if it's a little difference in turning people's attention towards this issue. And the one thing at the level of narrative that seems to really matter is when students, when young people are the ones making this argument, because it is so existential to them. It's about their own
suffer the children, yeah.
And their own futures.
How do you see it play out?
Well, look, I am under no illusions that this would be an easy thing. It would have to be highly concerted. It would have to be a lot of different communities doing this in order for it to make a difference. But the one thing that I think it has going for it is that it would exercise real leverage. You know, one of the things that I feel frustrated by, I think a lot of us feel frustrated by, is the only weapon we seem to bring, sorry for the mixed metaphor here, but that we seem to bring to this fight over gun control is sort of moral outrage. You know, we have these moments that happen, we're all disgusted and horrified, and, you know, all we seem to be able to do is just yell, you know, how can this happen? You know, as if, you know, yelling it loudly enough will sort of convince policymakers. And what I'm trying to say is, look, we have to look for the pain points, for the actual leverage that communities, the people that care about this issue can use. And if COVID has taught us anything, sadly, it's that when kids don't go to school, all of society very quickly falls apart. You know, parents have to stay home. They have to deal with childcare. Basic services sort of begin to collapse because people are not there. It is a real lever. It's a real way of exercising power to say we are going to sort of withhold our participation in public life until this issue that goes to the very safety of our children, of ourselves, is dealt with in some way.
Well, I understand in concept the idea of a protest to get the demands, and we've seen large protests and movements create change in this country. Obviously, the civil rights movement being the one that comes to mind the most for me, or Vietnam. And you saw what happened after Parkland, where students rallied together and they had the big protests on in Washington. But I can't be fully supportive of kids staying out of school until something is done, because we all know that it's complicated to get laws passed in this country. And I don't know that it's necessarily beneficial to children or their parents or the communities to have kids out of school for a long period of time. You're not going to get bills passed in Congress in a couple of days. These things can take weeks or months. So, and given the fact that going to school is compulsory in every state in the nation, they would actually be breaking the law if they stayed out of school for multiple days at a time. So, and I don't know whether it would have the same impact. There would be residual effects of that. So in concept, I get it. But I worry about in practicality how that would actually work.
It also just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So you've had, Columbine 23 years ago. This isn't a new issue, tragically. And yet you do polling. Issue polling, which I have all sorts of problems with in terms of its reliability, will tell you, though, that a majority of Americans, as you said, are in favor of, for instance, banning assault weapons. But they're not voting that way. And so intensity matters, and what people are willing to vote on matters. When we talk about school shootings, and again, I had a nice long cry last week over some of this stuff. I have a small child as well. But since Columbine, if you average the number of children and staff who've been killed in schools of all types before college, it's 7 a year, compared to 120 who are killed every year on school transportation. When we talk about the gun problem, these are the ones that get the most attention. These are the 1%. These are the 9/11s. but they're not where the majority of the problem is. That's in suicides, first of all. And then second, it's in crime. And so when we look at solutions, that's where I think we should be looking to see what we can prevent on that. And then we just have to hope that it will have some effect on these 1% cases. But if we make a lot of laws on the 1%, I think you end up with something you don't want. You end up with a lack of due process. You end up with more mass incarceration. And obviously, kids walking out of school will get attention. But if the last 23 years hasn't changed voter behavior on guns, I don't know why that would.
Well, actually, a Scientific American article pointed out that guns now kill more children and young adults than car crashes do. So when you talk about transportation accidents, there it is. Gall, your response.
Well, it's not about getting attention. It's about actually trying to exercise some real, to create a constituency around this issue for gun control, for regulation. I think part of the problem in this country is that the people who, and it is a majority, and you might say that, that when you look at voting, that tells you one thing, but we also have a structure of government in Senate that it gives a disproportionate amount of power when you look at demographics, disproportionate amount of power to people who like guns, and what I am suggesting here is that we need to put in some hard work and sacrifice in order to make something actually happen. That yes, the last 23 years are depressing to look at, and it's partly because I think the people who care most about this issue assume that everyone is as upset about it as they are and will naturally sort of lead to a changing of laws, but that doesn't ever seem to happen. And so, you know, to me, the model here is, take the Montgomery bus boycott, in the mid-1950s, when for over a year, the Black citizens of that city didn't take the bus to work, didn't have that mode of transportation. It created a real hardship on them, just in the way that it would create a hardship for all of us to keep our kids out of school. And they created committees to carpool and to get each other around. And that hard work and sacrifice had enormous payoff. They managed to get rid of the discriminatory laws in that city. So that to me is sort of the way we need to be thinking about this, not just sitting around and waiting for the next attack to happen.
That also took a long time. The boycott was a year. Yeah, so kids are supposed to stay out of school for a year? I have to push back on that. We saw what happened. We saw the hardships with COVID and kids not going to school because of a pandemic and how that changed voter behavior, where in like states like Virginia, where that was, people were single voter issues on that because they needed their kids back in school. And the disruption, not just to the kids' education, we're seeing more data how that impacted children negatively by not being in school, but also what it did for parents. What about the single parents that don't have options to put their kids in homeschooling? They have to work. I mean, I just don't see how this works practically. I think it's a great academic exercise, but in real life, I just don't see this as a viable solution.
People living in Montgomery could have said, well, how am I going to get to work? I think that it's precisely
that's different than children.
It's precisely the hardship that I'm talking about, that I'm not welcoming, but it's the hardship that actually might influence politicians to do something. Yes, I'm being dreamy. Yes, it's entirely hypothetical, but here's the thing. We need imagination on this issue. We can't just sit here in a room together and talk about how, all the reasons why nothing can change. That to me is unacceptable. And it's often too much of what happens in these situations. We've seen this cycle so many times, and I think people are as frustrated with that as anything else. And so, I'm throwing a dart at the wall. I encourage other people to do so as well. There has to be a way that we break through this logjam.
Special guest Gall Beckerman, senior editor at The Atlantic and author of the book, The Quiet Before, on the unexpected origins of radical ideas. Gall Beckerman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Sarah Isger and Tara Settmayer. We'll be back with more inflation. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC. straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your guest host, Gustavo Arellano, and the left, columnist at the Los Angeles Times. On the right is Sarah Isger, staff writer at the Dispatch. From the center, we're joined by Tara Settmayer. She's a senior advisor at the Lincoln Project and a former GOP communications director on Capitol Hill. She's also a resident scholar at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. Now, shifting topics to inflation, the White House announced this week that it would focus on inflation and the economy for real this time over the next month. This came after reports that Biden is fuming that his aides are not out there showing more concern and understanding about the economy. An NBC News poll earlier this month found that only 33% of Americans approve of Biden's handling of the economy and only 23% approve of his handling of the cost of living. Sarah, how serious of a hazard are Biden's low numbers on this issue going to matter in the midterms?
It is the only thing that will matter in the midterms. I think just the vast, vast majority of voters are saying that this is their number one issue. Now, underneath that, it's maybe an umbrella issue when you talk about inflation. I think gas prices are part of that. I think baby formula shortage is part of that. By the way, still a problem. Here we are, started in February. It is June now. Baby formula still not easily available to a lot of moms who need it. They're flying baby formula over from Europe. The Abbott plant still isn't up and running. And that, I think, goes to, it's like a discrete example of the incompetence issue that you had a lot of voters in 2020 who maybe voted for Donald Trump in 2016 or were on the fence and who said, look, it was too much chaos. It was too much incompetence. Joe Biden, he's been doing this for a long time. I don't have to pay attention to the president if Joe Biden's in the White House. I'm going with that. And unfortunately, what you saw was with the pullout in Afghanistan, people suddenly paying attention and saying, well, wait, that was not competence. That was not the sort of smooth sailing that I was expecting from a Biden administration. And it's been one thing after another. And obviously, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen this week coming out and saying that she just got it wrong, that they didn't understand all of the forces that could drive up inflation. A huge problem for the administration. And as I said, I don't know. I mean, saying you're going to focus on this for 1 month in June, way too late, way too little. And it's at this point in November, Democrats are already bracing for what they know is coming.
Tara, when you hear high-level officials saying, oops, we got it wrong, what does that do to the public at large in terms of wanting to vote for them come November?
Well, clearly it doesn't instill confidence in the current leadership. You know, it's great to admit mistakes when you make them, but on an issue like this, where the president and the administration in charge they're responsible for making the people feel as though they're competent. it doesn't really help the situation. And unfortunately for Biden and for Democrats, the poll numbers reflect that lack of confidence by the American people. This is the timing of this could not be worse for the president or for Democrats going into midterms. Oftentimes, the economy is the number one issue unless there's a terrorist attack or something like that that will supersede it. But if you look at polling over the years, it's the economy is always number one because that's what impacts people's lives every single day. The kitchen table issues, to Sarah's point, gas prices, the cost of food, the basic costs of living. That's what people pay attention to because it literally impacts them every day. The idea of inflation being number one, well, no, because inflation impacts so many different things. But those specific measurements, those metrics, that's what you can gauge the mood of the country on oftentimes. When you have that 75% of the country saying it's going in the wrong direction, that's not a good sign for the administration. So there are several areas where they didn't react soon enough. Last year when they said it was just transitory and that it would go away and it would correct itself, I think they were slow to respond. But what's unfair to President Biden is that he cannot wave a magic wand and just change things and change inflation. No one knew that there would be a war in Ukraine. That impacts gas prices globally because it's a global market. Other aspects of the COVID relief more people, more Americans had more money, and they hoarded their money and saved it, which, you know, impacts inflation as well. And so there are three areas here. You have monetary policy, fiscal policy, regulatory policy, trade policy as well. It fits in there. These are all areas that contribute to inflation that there are not easy fixes to. So the administration needs to start, they're a little behind the curve already, but they really need to move aggressively on doing things that will bring down some the cost of basic daily living for the American people, whether that's rescinding some of the Trump-era tariffs that have contributed to this, doing more to help loosen up the supply chain, which has contributed to this. Immigration has contributed to this because of the lack of workers in a lot of these areas, trying to help with that. Even in the baby formula issue, stems back to a Trump-era policy where you had a 17-cent tariff on importing European baby formula. So we weren't able to, you know, import those added supply when the Abbott factory went down due to a health issue, a bacteria found in the factory. We weren't able to easily import the supply. Same thing with the with the new NAFTA that was negotiated under the Trump administration, disincentivized folks from importing from Canada. So these are things that the administration could, in fact, reverse fairly immediately without congressional intervention. So
why do you think they're not doing it?
Well, I mean, there's reverberations with other areas as well. But I would have to admit, I would have to believe that there is discussion about this because it's between what the Fed will do, with rising interest rates to try to level things out. We've seen that happen in the past. We saw what they did in the 80s when inflation was an issue. But Ronald Reagan also lost a significant number of seats in Congress during his midterm over this issue until it righted itself. And then he won re-election in a landslide. So they may have to pay a price before they can right the ship. But, you know, Democrats and the administration don't want to hear that in a midterm election year, given what's at stake.
The Biden administration, they announced funding for, you know, directly to address this food supply chain issue, but to help smaller meatpacking plants hit hard by the pandemic. And critics are saying this isn't where we should be spending money when the issue is about inflation and supply chain infrastructure. But with food becoming so expensive, Sarah, isn't it important to focus on what can be done right now so people can actually eat and not spend so much?
This is the tension, you know, a lot of the quick solutions could actually make inflation worse in the long term. And so how do you balance that? As you said, people need food now, but also it doesn't do them any good if the food prices keep going up because now you're subsidizing food and spending more money from the government that, by the way, the government doesn't have. And we see this with gas prices. I agree entirely with almost everything Tara said, by the way. There's no quick flip switch that Joe Biden can flip on any of this stuff. But there's some stuff longer term that could reduce gas prices over time, but that conflicts with the Democrats' priorities on climate change issues and energy. And obviously on immigration, it's it's an intransigent political issue that neither side really wants to tackle. And so everyone's interested in that short-term fix because they're looking at the midterm elections. And it's one of the problems, I think, with our current political environment, that it's always about the next election, and the next election is always ongoing. So I think I agree with Tara entirely. Not all of this is Joe Biden's fault. Some of it is long-term problems that we've built in. I think her point about the baby formula is well taken. And I'll even expand it, that part of that is that the Department of Agriculture gives basically mini monopolies to individual states on baby formula. And then you had the tariffs on top of it. And then you had the Abbott plant go down. So there's a lot of government incompetence to go around. Joe Biden's at the helm of the ship. And not only will this be bad for Democrats, I think, obviously, this fall, but you look at then that Senate map for 2024, and it's even worse. So I think they are a bit paralyzed by how bad this is, how bad it can get, and how bad it can get if inflation continues at the pace that it's going, which could be exacerbated by some of the spending that the Biden administration is talking about for those short-term fixes.
But maybe Biden sees, you know, what's ahead for the Democrats right now, especially if the economy continues how it is. And maybe he does throw a Hail Mary and does all the things that Tara was talking about, these short-term gaps to try to improve the economy, to try to make Americans say, hey, look, Biden's finally, you know, I've always tried to give credit to Joe. I always try to say, like, he's going to make it happen. 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 How long have I been saying this now for? He's going to make it happen and again and again. But now we're talking, we're using the metaphors of ships. November is a humongous iceberg. How do the Democrats melt that iceberg?
Oh boy. If we had the answer to that, I think,
you wouldn't be where you're at. Yeah,
exactly.
You'd be Democrats.
Listen, this is a Herculean problem for the Democrats. But November is also an eternity away. In politics, a lot could happen between now and November. But one thing I do know, and as a former communications director on Capitol Hill, is I understand messaging. And the Democrats really, really need to be unified in their messaging on how to approach this. They need to listen to their constituents and do the Bill Clinton, I feel your pain. Otherwise, their constituents, even the constituencies who have been loyal to them, may say, you know what, if you're not going to do anything or you're not understanding our hardships, we're going to vote for the other guy. They have to be unified in this. And part of the difficulty for President Biden has been that he hasn't had a unified Democratic Party. He's had to fight uphill battles with the progressive wing of his party. He's tried to placate them. It's never good enough. So he has to battle. He's got a 360 battle going on here on all sides. And it's reflecting itself in his polling because it looks like he's paralyzed and can't get anything done. Nancy Pelosi understands this. The OG triumvirate in the House, I like to call them, of Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, and Clyburn, they understand how to get things done. But then you run into the iceberg in the Senate, to continue the metaphor, where things go to die, it seems. So I hope that Democrats can at least message this better if they have any hope of getting anything done and keeping control of at least the House or the Senate.
Sarah, what do you think?
I want to give a big picture problem here that Joe Biden has. And again, I think it's really important to acknowledge that not everything is Joe Biden's fault or in his control, even if some things are. The Democratic Party has moved to the left on policy issues over the course of the last 10, 15 years, and in some cases dramatically, so that they've left behind a lot of their median voters. And it's why we're seeing in the wake of the Trump era a transformation of both political parties in terms of who their median voter is. Lots of people have said this on the left. David Shore, Obama data guy, for instance, is maybe most famous for talking about popularism. And it sounds really dumb to say that politicians should pursue policies that are popular. And yet, neither party actually is very good at it. Why? Because we have a broken election system where if you are most concerned about getting reelected, which the vast majority are, then what you're actually concerned about is being flanked from your base, getting a primary challenge from the right or from the left. And in the Democrats' case, from the left. That's what's drawing Democrats to the left. And it's these primaries that are partisan, where you're having fewer and fewer people participate compared to a general election, picking people at the more extreme to the more of the base. And so it pulls the Democratic Party in a way that Joe Biden can't control. And then the Democratic Party is no longer pursuing popular ideas. You know, the whole debate over forgiving student loans, that's actually not a particularly popular idea because the vast majority of voters didn't go to college or don't have college debt. We're talking about helping, by and large, wealthy people, you know, people with graduate degrees who took on massive amounts of debt and also are able to pay it off.
But you also get working class students. I see your point, but you also get students, working class students who were told we got to go to college, and now they get into whatever profession they are, and they are still living at home with their parents. They're still paying off these debts forever and ever. And so it's interesting coming from the Latino, the Latino Democrats, because I cover this in Southern California, you have these existential death matches, right now between the old guard, the Chicano sources, and then you have the young progressives. And the young progressives on the Latino side, they have been winning in Southern California. They have been winning wherever they're have. You know, you saw the 2020 election with Bernie Sanders, where Bernie crushed Joe Biden in California because of these young Latinos going out all out for their Tio Bernie. So it's, but on the other hand, yeah, like maybe you could win for the future, but you're not winning nationally.
Right. California isn't representative at all. Just like Twitter would be the most liberal congressional district in America. And you have then Latino voters in Texas, in Florida, and even on that border in New Mexico.
Yep.
Now turning dramatically to the right. So not following the demographics is destiny model that Democrats were trying to follow 20 years ago, where they said, stay the course, make it about identity politics. That's not working with the Latino vote anymore. And weirdly, we're seeing even in Joe Biden's approval numbers, the largest drop in approval coming from Black voters, which was really surprising to me as well. And, you know, on the student issue, on the student loan issue, sure, but A, it could drive inflation. And B, we're talking about fixes that don't make sense for the long term. What we should do is hold colleges responsible for giving people degrees in underwater basket weaving that have, you know, cost them $100,000 and have no actual career prospects.
It opens up your perspective on the world.
As someone who is in her 40s and still paying off her student loans, I didn't take underwater basket weaving at George Washington University, but it was very, very expensive. And but I'm glad I did it. But it seems a little, it does saddle you for decades with student debt and with interest rates. It's like we need to figure out a way to fix this, because I'm not the only one. I'm blessed to be able to have the means to pay to repay it. But many aren't. So blanket forgiveness, no, I don't think that's a good idea, because somebody has to actually pay for that money that was borrowed. There is no money tree on the White House South Lawn or on the West Lawn of the Capitol. And a lot of people forget that. Nothing is actually for free. But it just to wrap this all up, we're going back to the political expediency of some wins for the Biden administration, and they're desperately looking for them, evidenced by the most recent decision to do some student loan forgiveness. But also you see the administration trying to focus in on tackling inflation, on tackling the gun issue, on tackling gas prices. Whether they can hold it all together and whether it resonates remains to be seen.
And we've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants, featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Sarah Isker, what's on your mind?
You know, I just think that the best use of my minute here is to talk about how we need, as a country, to stop taking individualized situations and trying to make them into some broader narrative. And what do I mean this week? I mean the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial. This was a defamation lawsuit between two clearly very damaged people. The jury found actually that both had defamed each other over the course of their marriage related to violence in that marriage. That's what it is. That's what this case was actually about. It's not about misogyny or Gamergate or any other large-scale cultural issue, the end of the Me Too era or men's rights activism. Nope, stop. It's about these two people and a sad marriage that maybe we didn't all need to be voyeurs into. Just let them do their thing and leave it alone.
Tara Settmayer, what's your rant?
So mine is actually piggybacking off of Sarah's. I didn't know what her rant was going to be ahead of time, but my pet peeve is also concerning the Amber Heard, Johnny Depp trial. But it comes more from the perspective of, as a country, I'm really annoyed by how much attention this trial got. It is a bunch of celebrities and their toxic relationship and the idea that so many people were invested in this. It bothers me because we are facing real problems in America. And next week, we are starting the January 6th hearings. And that's really where the American people's focus needs to be, because we're actually talking about threats to our democracy, the future of our democracy, the responsibility of leaders who were engaged in the insurrection to try to overturn a free and fair election in this country, which is the hallmark of our democracy and our freedom. And yet more people, I suspect, will have watched the Depp kept trial with interest than they will the primetime and multiple hearings that we're having on something that is actually really important. So I just don't like the voyeuristic aspect of the celebrity gossip for things that really don't matter in people's lives. And I just hope that we're able to get people's attention on something as important as what happened on January 6th.
And for my rant, I could care less about Johnny and Amber, but this week, large swaths of Southern California implemented some of the most stringent water restrictions ever in the region. And in a state that's part of the worst drought in the American West in 1,200 years, that's saying something. In Los Angeles, people can now only water their gardens 4 minutes a day, twice a week. That's it. So millions are wailing at the coming browning of their lawns. But to them, I say, hey, whiners, make sure to put some Home Depot buckets under your cheeks to collect all of those tears and then tear out your lawns. They're a waste of water, of fertilizer, of gas and time. Plant in some tomatoes, some squashes, put in a drip irrigation system if you really need it. Fruit trees. Gardening is beautiful. It's therapeutic, but you got to spend time with it, not let the sprinklers spray all sorts of runoff on dumb grass. The drought is real, Angelenos. Act like it. And full disclosure, by the way, I have a lawn. I want to rip it all out, but my immigrant dad won't let me because he says, no, se mira bonito la casa con zacate, that it makes my house look nice, this grass. And so when immigrants think lawns are the epitome of the American dream, yeah, we are doomed. And that's all the time we have for today. Thanks to Sarah Isger, Tara Setmayer, and Gall Beckerman. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dine Million. Big shout out to Laura, as this is her last show for a while. Enjoy the summer break after 6 months of civilized yet provocative labor. Our production assistant is Sarah Singer Schiff. The show is recorded and mixed by Matt Schwartz. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Gustavo Ariano. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center. Gracias.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
From PRX.